Welcome to The Blast Zone, the podcast where we dig up the bombs that shook Hollywood and try to find out why they went up in flames. This week, step away from the succulent breakfast. This is Napoleon. Welcome, welcome, welcome to The Blast Zone.
Welcome to The Blast Zone.
We are not a podcast about bad movies. We are a podcast about movies that did badly.
That's right.
I am John Drake, in-house film critic of my Letterboxd account.
And I'm Ian Dukes. I'm a person with thoughts and feelings, and some of them are about movies.
Movies like Napoleon, which we'll be talking about today. But before we get into that, Ian, how you been this week?
Feeling a little off. Had a little problem with my duty, jury duty.
Oh, God.
They caught me. They make you call every night for a week. You were telling me this is not the same everywhere, but in LA, you call every night for a week to see if you're due to come in the next day. I almost got through it. And then Friday, they got me. Mm. And then they let me go. But then there was a big catch. They're making me come back in 10 days. And they want me to serve on a month-long trial. I don't really want to do any of that, so I'm going to try to squeeze out of it. But it's a lot of stress for something I didn't do.
Tell them you were storming the Capitol in 2021. And you've been in and out of the court system yourself, maybe they'll let you loose.
Maybe if I bust out my QAnon shaman horns and I wear them down to the courthouse, I will be escorted away.
Now you're making me a little nervous. I hope I was correct when I said you only have to call once. Otherwise, there's probably warrants out for my arrest because I called once and they were like, no, you're good. And I was like, all right, cool. And they just stopped following
I was like, yeah, it sucks. You have to call all week. There's five different moments where you're receiving your verdict to whether you're sentenced to come in. And you're like, oh, no, that's not how we do it.
Sounds cushy. I hope that's not how we do it now that this whole scenario is making me nervous. But yeah, jury duty's lame. I've never actually done it. Let's just say what it is. I've ignored jury duty summonses for most of my life. Grew up living in New York City and I just never responded to them. And this probably warrants out for me in New York, or maybe the statute of limitations has passed now because I haven't lived there in a long time. But yeah,
I feel like a lot of people get away with that. It must be that they just don't have the bandwidth to go after people. As long as they fill the courtrooms, they're not sweating it too much about who didn't show up.
The thing is, I moved around a decent amount. So I was like, I never signed for receipt of the document, so they can't prove that I ever actually got the summonses.
Yeah.
Hopefully it doesn't come back to bite me. If anyone from the New York Justice Department is listening to this podcast, disregard everything I said.
Let's hope the pod is not interrupted by a sharp knock at the door.
I hope nothing comes of it and you're able to get out of it.
Me too. Thank you.
Especially because we just took a long break.
I know. We don't need more breaks.
We're getting back into it. Yeah. I'm excited. I'm going to see Nate Bargatze tomorrow, who's one of my favorite stand-up comedians.
Oh, fun.
I haven't been to a stand-up show in a little bit, so that'll be a good time seeing him in New York, actually. So if there are warrants out for me, I better just mind my P's and Q's when I'm
this
there.
This is your chance. What if it's not a real Nate Bargatze show and Al Pacino set you up on a sting?
It's an elaborate ruse.
It's a sting to get you.
That feels elaborate for my crimes, but anything is possible.
No, I hope it's a good show. He's a lot of fun. He's very wholesome and funny.
Yeah, and I'm married. I'm a dad. So like a lot of his material is tailored to my demographic.
Totally.
A lot of kid jokes, wife jokes, but I would never joke about my beautiful wife, Jamie. She's the best.
She's your Josephine.
She's my Josephine. No.
Oh, no, not in any of those ways. Just in your devotion.
She's not going to die of diphtheria or whatever.
just in your poetic devotion and none of the other ways, which will be discussed during the course of this movie. Maybe in that way. I don't know.
Yeah, you're not privy to those details. But all right, before we get too deep into Napoleon or Josephine, as it were, let's tell the listeners what you watched this week that you wanted to share with them.
I watched something fun, which is always a good thing when that happens. A movie called Self-Reliance. It's brand new. It's out on Hulu.
Yes, I watched it too.
You watched it too. It's written, directed, and starring Jake Johnson, who we both like, who you turned me on to back in the day when you said you got to watch New Girl. He's co-written a few other movies. I looked this up, but this is his directorial debut. Now, Lonely Island Classics are among the production companies that are billed on this movie, and Andy Samberg actually has a small role in this movie, and those are just some of the similarities between Self-Reliance and 2020's Palm Springs, which we also both really liked. They're both quirky personal growth stories that have a lot of good comedy in them, but a kind of a surreal sci-fi-ish premise that's driving the plot. Now, Self-Reliance doesn't quite hit the highs that Palm Springs got to. Palm Springs was just a little more emotional, a little funnier, a little deeper. But this movie's funny. It's charming. It's definitely worth a watch. And it's only $1.25, man. This is a short movie. Comes in an hour, 25 minutes. Why wouldn't you watch it?
Jake Johnson is a favorite of mine. I really enjoyed, I think I brought Ride the Eagle to Show and Tell once, not too long ago.
Okay.
Also saw his other writer credit Win It All, which is another good kind of breezy. Like his movies tend to be breezy, short, small cast. and just real fun times. But he's got a little bit of a darkness to him too, which, yeah, you know, he doesn't shy away from in this movie either. You left out a pretty important part of Self-Reliance. It's got a major supporting role from Biff Whiff.
That's right.
Detective Crashmore himself.
Yes.
Or Santa Claus.
Yeah, quite a delight for I Think You Should Leave fans. He has a major supporting role. Anna Kendrick is maybe the main co-star.
Yeah.
But he's almost as big a role, if not like as big on screen time. It's a cool cast.
There are a lot of good, I would almost call them cameos. Like people show up for one scene, and I won't spoil those. But then you got like Mary Holland in a little role, and she's just really funny people everywhere. Jake Johnson probably called in a few favors for this one.
He's got a lot of funny friends, and they're helping him out making this.
I just wish we could have gotten, and I know he's probably doesn't want to do this. He wants to separate himself from his most prominent role, but I would have loved an appearance from one of the gang, from the Loft gang. Lamorne Morris.
Yeah.
Would have made my day, because we just finished Fargo with Lamorne Morris, and I'm like, man, I need more of this guy in my life. He's just not enough stuff for me.
I haven't seen him in a while, which is partly why I'm looking forward to catching up on Fargo.
It's over now, so you can binge it, so dive in whenever. I also watched something pretty fun this week. I did a double feature. Oh. I watched the film Dark Waters about the DuPont chemical scheme, and I won't even call it like a scandal because like it was pretty willful. It feels like a scheme, like they were scheming to get away with this. And then I watched, because I was so infuriated by this movie, I was like, I just want to be infuriated for even longer. So I tracked down the documentary about the same thing that came out a year before the movie called The Devil We Know and watched that. All I have to say is fuck DuPont and fuck chemical companies everywhere. And yeah, self-regulation is a myth because capitalism rewards people for racing to the bottom.
Yeah.
And being the biggest pieces of shit they can possibly be. Let me tell you, DuPont Chemical are pretty huge pieces of shit. They're now folded into Dow Chemical. They were acquired, I believe.
Okay. But
about the movie, though, if you like a political courtroom thriller in the vein of Michael Clayton or almost any Mark Ruffalo movie, which he is the star of this movie as well, you'd be investigating some shit. And Mark Ruffalo investigating some shit is one of my favorite film genres. And this is a great one. It's a little different. He's Southern in this one, so it's got a little twist on it.
That is a twist.
And he's not a cop. He's a lawyer. We've seen him be a cop a few times, a journalist. He's played all different spectrums. This time he's a lawyer who reluctantly takes on this case after a farmer who knows his grandmother basically comes to him and says, there's something wrong with my soil and my water and my feed and everything. Ooh. Is going, like, his cows are dying and they have black teeth and they're going crazy.
Yeah, that shit creeps you out, man. And it's horrible when it's a true story.
And it's because of Teflon, the famous nonstick chemical. But luckily this case brought a lot of attention to Teflon and got DuPont to stop using it completely in 2002, I believe. But they replaced it with an almost identical chemical called Gen X, which has been linked to the same.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, so I'm going to throw away all my nonstick
Wait, is this true?
Cooking
is,
stuff.
Is the ceramic stuff okay? Or is that the same deal? It's just got a friendly name.
Ian, I'm not the fucking EPA. I don't know what's okay for you.
What does Mark Ruffalo say? I need answers. I got to be safe. My kitchen.
Let's get Ruffalo on the phone. He needs some answers that Mark Ruffalo might not have.
He will pursue them obsessively until he gets to the bottom of this.
Probably at the cost of his personal life, maybe even his marriage.
Most likely.
It seems to be how it goes. But it's one of those movies that you admire for being so well made, but also you're like, fuck.
Yeah.
The world is so shitty. So yeah, Dark Waters is the movie and The Devil We Know is the documentary. Both excellent. I recommend both of them. And Dark Waters was actually Todd Haynes, who just did May, December.
Okay.
Which was a hot button. We were on hiatus when that came out. I did watch it. I did like it, but it was a bit of a hot button topic in the film world because it tackled some pretty uncomfortable subjects.
It sounds really interesting and I haven't seen it yet, but I know that I need to.
It's actually would be a fun double feature with That's My Boy because it tackles like a student teacher relationship where they stay in love beyond like them getting found out and all the consequences, except it has a very different tone.
Let's hope most movies have a different tone than That's My Boy.
Still probably our most hated movie, but we're not here to talk about that. We're here to talk about Napoleon. Now, Ian, what'd you know about Napoleon before this? Were you a history buff? Were you into him? Did you collect his penis in a jar like Conor Roy from Succession?
I didn't even know that Conor Roy did that. I knew very little about Napoleon. I can't even remember studying European history at any point. I had the vaguest outlines of what his role was in history and the vaguest outlines of what this movie might be. I came into it a fan of Joaquin Phoenix, just in general, and Ridley Scott. And the immediate feeling you get is something indulgent is happening with these two gentlemen and this movie, and it's likely to be ridiculous. And so I had a little bit of anticipation I wasn't super excited for, and it felt like it got to streaming really fast. So I didn't really even have too much time to think about this movie before I was there watching it.
I feel like Joaquin Phoenix, like when I first heard about Ridley Scott making a Napoleon movie, I rolled my eyes because I'm like, period pieces, these kinds of European battle epics, we've seen it all. Even this is like a historical fiction, because this is basically historical fiction in a lot of ways, full of bloody battles. Like we've seen Ridley Scott do this before. He did Gladiator, Kingdom of Heaven. This is well-trodden territory for him. Even The Last Duel, yeah, which was pretty recent, is in a similar vein. But Joaquin Phoenix just lends an air of credibility to everything he does. So once he was signed on, I was kind of like, okay, I'll give it a shot. I'll go into it with an open mind. And this movie is not what I expected at all. This movie's fucking weird. I have a lot of problems with it, but at the end of the day, I'm still like, man, I still enjoyed watching it. It's hard to parse what the movie is trying to tell you about Napoleon with what most people know about him, even from just a very casual research into his life.
I also didn't know what to expect. And the movie just, it entertains. It's very watchable, but it's light. I called this movie a light film in heavy clothing because there's a lot of costuming. There's a lot of palaces and shit, but there's not that much substance to what's going on. At least the gravity you expect when you're talking about a world historical figure like Napoleon. It's not so much about that. It's about his personality. It's like a character study focused around his relationship with Josephine, which we will get into in great detail as soon as we start to talk about that.
Because the movie gets into it in great detail. I read a couple reviews that were like, this movie should be called Napoleon and Josephine, because it tends to look at everything once he meets her through the lens of like, how does this impact his relationship with Josephine?
Yeah.
Everything he does is tied to her.
Seriously. And maybe it would have done better. Like, that would be a way to market the movie so that people at least knew what they were going in for and weren't disappointed that it was not this or that, because otherwise you kind of make up what you think you're going to get. And as a movie about Napoleon and Josephine, I think it doesn't disappoint.
But it was called Napoleon, and people wanted the story of his life, and you don't really get that. It's very, like you said, it's light, and I would compare it almost to somebody who read the Wikipedia and just wrote a script without doing any further digging, or like a Cliff Notes version of a Napoleon biography. It's like, then this happened, and then this happened, and then he went here, and then he went back home, and then he went here.
There's some key milestones in there that you're like, oh yeah, I've heard of Austerlitz, I've heard of Waterloo, and they show them to you, but it goes by pretty fast. And I also drew the parallels to Maestro, which I brought in as a show and tell recently. You go in thinking these are straight up Hollywood biopics, and they both chose to not really put a lot of focus on the big historical milestones, but more talk about the personality, the central love affair of the main character's life. But both kind of fell a little short of centering the women, because we know the women in both movies pretty much only through how Napoleon reflects on them, how they handled this weird guy, which is a lot. It certainly shaped their lives. But it's not really Josephine's movie. They're both movies about a narcissistic guy who puts his own drives and desires above even those people that he loves the most. But he's actually kind of a genius, and we got to recognize that. It's kind of what both of them seem to be saying.
And I would say the main difference between the two, though, is that Bradley Cooper seems to really admire Leonard Bernstein. I don't think that Ridley Scott admires Napoleon. I think he kind of hates him.
It's definitely a different type of subject to tackle. Bradley Cooper went in with Bernstein's living children and got them all on board. Whereas, as you will detail for us later, Ridley Scott was like, fuck the French, they're idiots. And, you know, there's a lot more historical distance where you can come up with your own opinions about Napoleon.
Should I get right to the heart of the matter, where that quote came from, and I can tell people a little bit about the development of the movie?
Yeah, for sure. Let's hear how this thing happened.
All right. Sir Ridley Scott is 865 years old. I'm sorry, 86 years old. Not to be ageist, but it's kind of insane he's still making movies on the scale and at the pace that he is. Since 2020, he's directed two episodes of TV show Raised by Wolves, historical epic The Last Duel, House of Gucci, short film Behold, and Napoleon. He's also got four projects in some stage of development. On October 14th, 2020, the same day he wrapped filming on The Last Duel, he announced his Napoleon biopic, then titled Kitbag, which was to be produced by 20th Century Fox. He had David Scarpa, who wrote 2017 Scott Baum, All the Money in the World, work on the screenplay.
Why'd you hire him again? He just lost all the money in the world.
Interestingly, the screenplay used Stanley Kubrick's unproduced script for his Napoleon epic as a blueprint, using roughly 80% of the script to cover more verifiable details, while Scarpa injected completely fabricated scenes and dialogue for entertainment purposes.
I like those scenes. I also use them for entertainment purposes.
Scott had his sights on Joaquin Phoenix for the lead role after being impressed by his performance in Joker, and eyed The Last Duel star Jodie Comer to play the pivotal role of Napoleon's wife, Josephine. Both initially agreed, but Comer would have to back out due to scheduling conflicts and was replaced by Vanessa Kirby. In January 2021, it was announced that Apple Studios had committed to financing and producing the movie, now set for a whopping $200 million budget. The movie would eventually be an Apple TV Plus streaming exclusive, but would also get a traditional theatrical release. On January 18th, 2022, it was announced that the film had been retitled to The Boring Napoleon, and production was set to begin in February 2022. Filming lasted only 61 days because Scott is an insane person, and post-production was underway. With a planned theatrical cut of 2.5 hours, Scott also announced announced his intention to release a 4-hour-plus director's cut to Apple TV Plus that would explore more of Empress Josephine. But we're still waiting on that. Released on November 22nd, 2023, Napoleon got mixed reviews from critics. Most enjoyed the central performances by Phoenix and Kirby, along with the battle scenes, but thought the movie was too long and did not give the historical figure of Napoleon his due. French critics hated it almost universally, accusing it of being pro-British and anti-French. The French also thought it was somehow too short, because they gotta be contrarians. Scott responded to criticisms of the historical accuracy of the film by asking, and I quote, "Were you there? Well, shut the fuck up then. What a G." The movie opened in second place with $20.6 million, behind the Hunger Games prequel The Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes, which was in its second week. It had a staggering 65% drop the next weekend, pulling in only $7.2 million.
Sounds like weekend two was its Waterloo.
It would continue to lose momentum, eventually clearing just over $210 million worldwide, well short of its estimated break-even point of $500 million.
Yikes.
This is not a good year for these biopics. You see, Ferrari is losing its pants right now.
I wonder who's greenlighting this stuff, because it feels like old people's stuff, and like maybe those same people aren't going to the movie theaters anymore.
I'm really glad they're making these movies and releasing them in theaters and giving them big budgets, but like you got to feel like the rug's going to get pulled out at some point, right?
Yeah, like even I, as a bona fide old person, like Ferrari, do I care? I don't know. Maybe if I was more of a car guy, I would, but...
We just had Ford versus Ferrari too, which I feel isn't helping matters.
Yeah, like I wasn't interested when you tried to sell it to me 2 years ago.
I liked Ford versus Ferrari, but like Ferrari was the bad guys in that. So it's interesting now that there's another movie where they're like, no, we must root for the Italians.
That's the thing is you've got these stars, Adam Driver, Joaquin Phoenix, that get movies made once they're signed on because they are compelling and the public does love them. But there's only so much they can do and not all these movies sell.
And I've seen a lot of people arguing that Apple didn't really care if the movie made a profit theatrically because it was going to be a prestige thing for them to have it exclusively on Apple TV Plus, but it's got a 58% on Rotten Tomatoes. I don't think it's winning any Oscars. I also think with the underperformance of Killers of the Flower Moon, they're not going to keep doing this indefinitely. You can say, oh, they don't care because they just want to get this stuff on their streaming platform, but the buck's going to stop at some point. They're going to stop financing these movies that lose hundreds of millions of dollars. This movie lost hundreds of millions of dollars for them.
Well, that's going to be painful. When you think about it, it's like maybe they're still going to gamble because what's the big difference between Oppenheimer and those other movies? They're biopics about old white guys.
Yeah. Oppenheimer's probably the lesser known of the three, and he did the biggest business.
Yeah. How did he do it? Was he just riding Barbie's coattails this whole time?
I don't know. I think Nolan has something to do with it. Nolan's one of the few directors, I think, that can sell a movie still, because his fan base tends to be younger than like the Ridley Scott or Scorsese fanboys, I would imagine.
Yeah.
And younger people go to the movies more. But are younger people going to the movies to see a documentary about Oppenheimer and the Manhattan Project? Like,
you're right. Nolan still has some like bro cred with his Batman days, whereas Scorsese's bro cred was there in the 80s in Goodfellas days, but that's worn off.
Yeah, Wolf of Wall Street might have gotten some bro cred, but that was still true. Over 10 years ago.
That's true. He got a little juice back in that stage. But yeah, and Ridley Scott had incredible cred back in the day. But like,
Gladiator.
Yeah, they're all a lot of old guys making movies. It's an interesting scenario. This one just didn't have the juice. And like you said, the big drop off at the box office in week two and the lower scores make it seem like the movie actually didn't deliver even as a prestige movie.
Yeah, I know a few people that saw this in theaters and they all universally said, this movie's weird. I'm not sure how I feel about it.
It's kind of a vehicle for jokes. It's a very
funny movie.
It's very funny if you're ready for it to be. I mean, even if you're not, there's jokes that you can't miss, but they do a lot of expensive work setting up epic battles, epic palaces, costumes, all the period shit to get off some funny jokes about a weird, quirky dude, which is, it's entertaining, but that's like a funny little payoff package wrapped in an enormous wrapper.
Napoleon marches into this room and gives this impassioned speech to, is it the English, I think? Yeah, he gives it to one of the Englishmen that he's trying to negotiate a peace treaty with, and they're not receptive. And he, you know, like, he does this whole, what you would expect from an emperor,
uh-huh.
I will crush you. And right before he leaves, he decides to cap it all off with, you people think you're so great just because you have boats. And then he storms out of the room.
Yeah.
What a weird fucking line. And
yeah.
I could not help but laugh.
He has a ton of funny lines like that, and Joaquin Phoenix makes them work. His casting is definitely one of the things that makes the movie work to the extent that it does, because he pulls them all off. Like, all his weird jokes, they're not too silly. It doesn't become broad. I started doing the little casting experiment in my mind. What if it was Nick Cage? It would be like too obviously funny, whereas here they're sort of surprisingly funny moments. And Joaquin Phoenix was perfect casting. You see him the whole time. You're like, yeah, that's Napoleon. And he's a fucking weirdo.
It's crazy to think that Joaquin Phoenix could be underrated in any category of acting. But I do think between watching Inherent Vice and this relatively close together, that he's underrated as a comedic actor. He's pretty gifted with his timing and just the way his facial expressions sell the silliness on screen.
Especially in both those movies, the setups are weird. The scenarios are weird. There's drama, there's danger, and then there's somebody being weirdly funny in the middle of it. And yeah, he's got really great timing and delivery for that kind of humor.
So do you want to walk through the plot and we can start going over some of these points in detail?
Yeah, let me crack open the history book.
All right.
In 1793, during the French Revolution, a confident and crafty young artillery officer named Napoleon, played by Joaquin Phoenix, distinguishes himself with a victory over English forces at the port of Toulon, and he is promoted. Shortly after that, the Reign of Terror is ended, and many aristocratic prisoners are freed, including a recent widow named Josephine, played by Vanessa Kirby. Napoleon meets Josephine at a party, and he's smitten. He courts her, and he wins her over with his determined interest, and she gets on board once she's convinced that he won't be put off by her history. They get married. Then in 1795, Napoleon is again promoted as he leads French troops in defeating an insurrection by royalists, followed by more military successes in Italy and in Egypt. He misses Josephine terribly, and after learning that she's being unfaithful, he returns to France prematurely to confront her. After a painful back and forth, they both agree they need each other. Then, in 1799, Napoleon and a handful of his allies depose the ruling council and take over control of the French government. Napoleon is now First Consul.
It is funny to me for Napoleon to be in Egypt, hear a rumor that his wife is cheating on him, and go back to France. That was like a 4-month trip.
Yeah, that's a good point. He's like, get some boats ready and don't tell anyone. I'm going home.
And he was still mad when he got there. He must have been pissed.
They do show you that he was capable of obsessing, and obsessing on her is pretty much what he does through the whole movie.
I said that his performance is pretty subdued. He plays Napoleon as above it all or disinterested, almost like a bored, gifted kid, you know? But then when Josephine is involved, there's like a sense of mania to him where he can't control himself.
He gushes over her. And I looked it up a little bit. Like, I don't know if the text of the letters they used was authentic. Napoleon did write a significant amount of love letters to Josephine every time he was away from her, and a lot of those made them into public hands. They got published both contemporaneously at the time, like you see some of them leaked into newspapers, and some of them came out as historical documents. So like, the movie isn't totally making all that stuff up. It's based on some reality, and it's a really interesting side to this man.
They actually nod to that, I think, when he goes to her house after he leaves Elba. He asks her servant what happened to the letters.
Yeah, the valet stole them and sold them to somebody.
Yeah, but let's talk a little bit about Napoleon before he meets Josephine. You had a note here about his hat, and I really appreciate that you called this out.
He's a hat guy, and you see him in the movie at first doing his military job, and he's wearing already a variety of versions of the same kind of hat. And then he goes to a party, and he's wearing the hat. And that's how you really know he's weird for the first time, because you look around this party, and he's the only guy wearing a hat at the party, and he won't take his hat off.
It's the Captain Crunch hat.
Yeah, it's great.
He's got his Captain Crunch hat on, and he looks quite silly. Let's be honest, it's a stupid hat.
The costume department did wonders, though. Like, they're really high quality. And every time you see him in one, it's a slightly different version, right? Like, it changes over time because the movie covers a good span of 30 years or something. They're all slightly different, but they're these amazing felt constructions, and they're huge and they're ridiculous, but it looks great.
I think it would have been awesome if every time he appeared, the hat got a little taller, like Doug Dimmadome, and eventually the hat's just like 8 feet tall. But no, it's a high quality hat, but like, it's stupid looking.
Yeah.
You can make a very well-made fedora with safari flaps, but that doesn't mean it's going to be stylish no. Or a good idea to wear it in public.
And the other officers are wearing similar hats, but his is always like a little bit bigger than everyone else's.
Is that just a perspective thing because he's so tiny?
Maybe.
He's got his Napoleon complex. But no, Joaquin Phoenix is he's a very good height for a man to be. A very normal height, I would say. Yeah. The perfect height. He's 5'8".
Totally cool and normal.
No need to ask me what my height is. I don't talk about that.
I looked this up too because the height is played pretty subtly in the movie, right? They don't mention it. No one accuses him of having a Napoleon complex or like coins the phrase in the middle of the movie like a cheesy biopic might. But like I read that up until recently, there was some misinterpretation of the measurement units, and people thought that Napoleon was 5'2", and now they think that he was probably more like 5'6", which isn't even terribly short. It's pretty average.
Especially, hasn't like the global height gone up since then? So 5'6" back then might have been average or maybe slightly above.
Yeah. I liked the way that Ridley Scott handled it. If you're looking for it, you can see that he's shorter than everybody in just about every scene, but not in a way that makes a silly thing out of it. It's just that's his life, is looking up to whoever he's acting across comes from, including Vanessa Kirby.
I like that it wasn't a focal point of the movie. Like that, it's unnecessary. It doesn't seem like it really informed any of his decisions, military or romantic or otherwise. So why make it a big deal?
Yeah, you just felt like this is who he was moving through the world, but it didn't make jokes about it. It made jokes about quite a few other things about him, but not that, which was classy.
One thing they don't really joke about, though, is his military prowess. For the vast majority of the movie, we just see him steamrolling people.
They set it up really good at the start. They call him to ask, what would you do about Toulon? And he's got a whole plan. He's like, it's not a city, it's a port. Here's how you take it. And he executes it really well. When you see him in battle, he does crafty things. He dresses up in disguise and goes and does reconnaissance himself, which is fun, which makes him seem very competent and plucky and clever.
Competent for sure, but he was also considered historically, and I'm no Napoleon expert, but I did a little bit of added research ahead of today's episode, and he was considered like a very charismatic military leader. Like his men loved him. He ate his meals with the infantrymen, and I think the movie doesn't really embrace that side of him. It tries to make him a little above it all, like I said before. Even when he's commanding, he's very soft-spoken, like he's not very animated.
No, except when he gets geeked out and starts hyperventilating and decides to join the battle hand-to-hand. But you're right, they show the troops loving him because that's necessary for the story, but they don't show him earning the troops' love except by winning battles.
But there was a little more to it than just that.
The military stuff always feels dumbed down, even in a movie like this, which handles it at a pretty good level of quality. Mostly, they illustrate his genius by knowing the right time to point his finger and say, shoot the cannons now. And, oh, that he's so genius. He shot the cannons at the exact right second when there's like a lot more hard work to the actual tactics of battle that he employed, probably.
I would say except Austerlitz. I think they did a good job of actually giving you the lay of the land in Austerlitz, which we'll get into when it comes up. But I was impressed with that sequence. And one thing I was surprised by, there are a lot of battles in this first section of the movie. And maybe I should have seen it coming because Ridley Scott traditionally does not shy away from the gore. But this movie's pretty bloody.
Jokes and gore. That's what this movie's got to offer you.
I mean, the opening scene is a decapitation via guillotine. We get a horse get decapitated, which is fucked up. I haven't seen that before.
The horse gets a cannon round right to his chest or its neck, and it's real gross.
Somebody tries to kill themselves by shooting themselves in the head and fucks it up. So he's just got a big bullet hole in his face. And then, there's a few more examples, but I was like, I don't know why. I felt like a Napoleon movie would be very buttoned up and proper because everyone's talking with such mannered ways and wearing these fancy outfits and these stupid fucking wigs. But then no. And that's good because it took me by surprise. And it's good when a movie can surprise you.
I think that contributed to why I had this feeling that I told you about when I was watching it, that Ridley Scott was like, I don't know where this movie's going, but I'm just having fun shooting scenes. And so like at the scene level, he's investing a lot of his juice into the movie, right? He's doing gory surprises or beautiful looking epic shots or these funny jokes. And like, they're all really funny or interesting moments individually. And the movie as a whole, you're like, why are we watching this? What was actually the meaning of Napoleon's life? We don't really have too much to hang on to there, but the scenes are fun.
The scenes are fun, but you're right. It's this happened, and then this happened, and then this happened, and then this happened, and the movie's over.
And he's good. Ridley Scott is no doubt good. So like, he can hit funny beats in all those scenes, or exciting ones, or shocking ones, and they're thrilling. But I think that leads to the feeling that everyone has, like, what was that about? Why did I watch that?
What was the point? But we do get to go to Egypt, which is cool.
The Egypt is another one of those candy. That's almost nothing plot-wise happening in that, except it's eye candy. It's fucking cool when there's bouncing cannonballs off the pyramids.
Yeah, now if you go to the pyramids, there's tourist stuff happening all there. But back in the day,
they don't let you do that.
No cannonballs. They got security and shit now. But and Egypt is, I think, where he decides to leave to go back to Josephine because he found out she's two-timing her with Paul, right? That's his name?
Was it? Yeah, there was her initial young lover. You see him on screen several times. I don't think he says a word.
He says something to her in the bedroom.
Does he? Okay.
Yeah, they have a little conversation, but I can't even remember what they talk about. So he goes back. He does the typical cheating spouse move of throwing all her shit out on the lawn
in the rain.
Which I thought was great. It's like, oh, they were doing that even back then. Interesting. And at first she kind of grovels and they seem to be reconciled, but he does make her embarrass herself to win back his approval.
It sets the tone for the relationship, which is a little confusing, especially this is the first time you see this dynamic play out, but he's like really mad and she's really sorry when she gets back to the house. Her stuff's on the lawn and he forces her to tell him that he's the most important thing in her world and nothing else matters. And then one scene later, literally it just cuts to fast forward a couple hours later, they're still sitting on the couch and she flips it on him.
You're nothing without me. Yeah.
Yeah. She makes him say almost the same thing back to her. And then in the morning, they're still on the couch and she's back to, I'm so sorry, please don't leave me. And it's like the sign of interesting, complicated relationship there that they both wield their power on each other and make each other grovel a little bit, but it whips you back and forth too fast. It's a little confusing.
There's almost too much time spent on the relationship for it to be a successful biopic, but there's not enough time spent on the relationship for it to be like a successful relationship drama.
Good point.
Because I was left with some big questions. Like, the movie is coy about how Josephine really feels about Napoleon.
Yeah.
There are times when you're like, oh, she seems really into him. And there are other times where you're like, she's just in it for the safety and security and the power that comes with it.
Right.
Even until the end of the movie, I was like, I don't know how she really felt about him. Because at the very end, she's like, no, I can't get in bed. Napoleon's coming. I have to be up to see him. And you're like, oh, I guess she really did have real feeling for him. But
yeah, that's a good point. And I think it's supposed to be that kind of complex thing. It was a marriage of convenience at first, and then she really does love him, and she discovers that over time. Even though the script is a little bit murky on all that stuff, I thought Vanessa Kirby was great. She has the presence to play off of this weird character, Napoleon. They're both weirdos in their own way. So even if it was slightly confusing, it was compelling the whole time they were acting together.
Yeah, I really liked Vanessa Kirby in this role, and I like her overall as an actor. And I also like Jodie Comer, but I do think Vanessa Kirby has an imperiousness to her that it makes you feel like she could challenge the most powerful man in the world and win. Whereas I don't know that Jodie Comer has that presence.
Oh, really? Because I was going to say the other way. I don't know Vanessa Kirby as well, but I'm like, Villanelle could kick Napoleon's ass. I think of Jodie Comer as more like would have been colder and more distant. She has that sort of freaky alien quality to her that she can pull off, but both really strong actors. Jodie Comer would have been good in it too, I think.
Yeah, of course. What about, you think Ruffalo could play Napoleon?
Ooh, I didn't think of Ruffalo. Ruffalo would be a really interesting Napoleon.
He's a little guy, right? He's 5'8". He could have pulled it off. And apparently not, you know, you don't need to be able to do a British accent or a French accent to play Napoleon.
No.
You just talk in your regular voice. Joaquin Phoenix just rolls up like, what's up, motherfuckers? I'm Napoleon.
I really like that choice from Joaquin and from Ridley Scott to be like, yeah, the other French guys are going to be mostly talking British because I guess they're British actors probably. And, you know, Joaquin, just talk your stuff normal. I mean, it's
talk your shit, King.
It was just comfortable. Like it, when you hear somebody doing an accent, even if they're good at it, draws some little part of your focus away from the performance. And this way it was like an unfiltered performance.
Yeah. And I think if the actor struggles with the accent, it definitely hurts their performance. So
yeah.
In a movie like this, where it's got to be, you got to nail it. You're in every scene. It makes sense to not get caught up on that. I agree. I don't think the movie loses anything by not having accents. It's not a Valkyrie situation. If you remember that movie, like Tom Cruise played a German Nazi who decides to overthrow Hitler, but he's just Tom Cruise. But then Eddie Izzard with him and he's just British Eddie Izzard. Like everyone just does their regular voices, which yeah. is strange.
Maybe there's something about if you put it far enough in the past, Napoleon is old enough to be like, I don't know what they sounded like back then, and I won't worry about it.
I think it would have been cool if you just said like a Baltimore accent.
I auditioned for The Wire. I never got that, but I worked up this great accent. I'm going to pull it out for Napoleon.
Got to go to Moscow down the ocean. Okay. You ready to walk through the middle of the movie?
Yeah. Why don't you tell us what happens next?
All right. As the proud new ruler of France, Napoleon makes peace overtures towards England and Austria, but they rebuff him, and he's pissed. His foreign minister, Talleyrand, fucking nursery rhyme-ass name, suggests that in order to get more respect from the crowned heads of Europe, Napoleon should declare himself a king. So in 1804, he does. Meanwhile, he and Josephine have a lot of sex, but she's yet to become pregnant and bear him an heir, which is a problem, and he threatens to divorce her. Next, Napoleon humiliates the emperors of Austria and Russia, defeating them soundly at the Battle of Austerlitz. Back at home, Napoleon tests his own fertility by impregnating a mistress, proving that Josephine is the problem. With a heavy heart, he divorces his only true love, Josephine, sending her to live in the Paris suburbs. While still pining for Josephine, Napoleon marries a young Austrian princess who bears him a son. On the politics front, Tsar Alexander of Russia allies with England, so Napoleon leads a massive combined European army in a march towards Moscow. After much fighting, he arrives in Moscow to find that Alexander has abandoned the city. Despite the lateness of the season, Napoleon decides to keep pursuing Alexander. But the Russian winter sets in and takes an enormous toll on his troops. After losing 500,000 soldiers in this defeat, things go from bad to worse for Napoleon as his allies force him to abdicate his throne and go into exile on the Isle of Elba. I just want to say here and now, let this be heard by all nations. Napoleon's dick game was trash. My man did not know what he was doing at all. He had no stroke.
Wait, you're blaming that for not getting the air?
No, it's just an observation. Oh. Yeah, I don't think it has anything to do with that. But and the air is a weird thing because he never really comes up again.
Oh, yeah. That there's a kid kid. Yeah. You see him when he's born, and then you see him as a toddler for a second, and then Napoleon's like, I got wars to do. That was it.
Because Napoleon's son ended up being a pretty decorated battle commander himself, and usually went out with Napoleon on a lot of his expeditions.
Oh, did he?
I think the movie might have aged him down.
Oh, yeah. Because, yeah, I felt like he was a toddler when Napoleon was like planning Waterloo, like the end of things. Maybe that's where it was not historically correct.
And if I got that detail wrong, I say to you, well, you there? Well, then shut the fuck up then.
I shall.
Yeah. So this is I'm sorry. I stepped on your note here. This is the section of the movie with, you think you're so great because you have boats, which is maybe the best line in the movie.
It's good. This is a movie that makes you write down the punchlines, and they're mostly Joaquin's punchlines because they're really funny and you want to back up and hear them again.
There's also the succulent breakfast one from the intro, which this fucking guy is so obsessed with his breakfast. He must say the word succulent breakfast like 5 times in a 3-minute scene. It's amazing. But love the jokes. They all landed for me. This movie's very funny.
And in between, there's a little bit of war.
Yeah. The Austerlitz battle scene is really cool. I was a big fan of this. Also, Austerlitz, the name of Conor Roy's ranch. The guy's really got a Napoleon thing going on.
Okay. The pieces are clicking now.
But this is the most detailed and well-executed battle scene we get. And I think it goes a long way towards cementing that the movie does agree that Napoleon was like a masterful battle commander, because he does a lot of cool shit in this battle. He's got cannons disguised, hidden on a ridge, like covered up with tarps and shit. He's in disguise doing his recon stuff again. He's back on his bullshit.
He is.
He lures the Austrian armies onto what they think is an open field, but is actually a frozen lake. So when they go to retreat, he just bombs the shit out of it with cannonballs and they all tumble into the frozen water. And what a fucked up way to kill a bunch of people.
Yeah.
And you see their bodies falling into the water and like all the red from their wounds. And it's gnarly, but awesome.
That's dramatic. It looks great. Ridley Scott captured the epicness of the battlefield and the scale of it all, as well as the intensity of it. I read that cannonball ice stuff was like maybe true, but it was a story that Napoleon told and they couldn't back it up that he actually killed a lot of guys that way. But it's a great way to make a battle like this cinematic, which are otherwise very hard. I mean, they're cinematic, but the story is hard to tell visually.
Right.
Whereas this is something that like really reads. They charge in and he's up on one side and he's like, now attack from the flank, drive him towards the ice. You can really tell what's happening in the battle, whether accurate or not. It turns on this flanking maneuver that drives him into the ice, and it's horrifying because being shot by a cannonball and falling into icy water are both pretty scary. And when it happens to you at the same time, it's no fun.
The movie does make a few nods towards Napoleon embellishing some of his conquests when he's speaking with the Emperor of Austria. And he says, the French only fight for money and England fights for honor, but I say we all fight for what we lack.
Yeah.
And the guy's like, that's not, like, you didn't say that. Like, that saying's been around forever. You didn't make that up. And he's like,
I think that was.
He just shrugs it off like, oh, yeah, whatever. Was that Tsar Alexander?
That was Tsar Alexander of Russia. And he's like, we say the exact same thing, but it's about the Turks. And that was a funny moment. That was good writing and good acting. And I thought actually the guy who played Alexander and the character of Alexander was the best of all the, there's a rotating bunch of side supporting dudes. Dudes in wigs that just roll through the screen one after another. And they're all good. They all have interesting faces and are compelling actors, but they move through fast and none of them has a big enough role to really latch onto. And that was the one guy that, despite his small part, I was like, oh yeah, this guy's interesting.
Yeah. And he visits Josephine later too.
Yeah. So he pops up again. He has a little scene with her.
Unclear what his motivation was in that scene though. I couldn't really parse that. Is he hitting on her? Is he just...
He kind of was, because that was kind of the role he played. He was the youngest of the European emperors and the most good looking. So he was like a threat to Napoleon to have him come around. But yeah, that actor's name is Edouard Philipponat, who is, I think, a Finnish-French actor. Hasn't been in anything big in English-speaking films that I could see, but he made an impression
except
on me.
This.
So yeah, except for this, I actually wrote down his name. That's how good I thought he was.
I made a comment to you when we were chatting about the movie that, like, it's really a two-hander between Kirby and Phoenix, and I can't even remember the names of any of the other guys. And you were like, actually, this one guy is pretty good. And I was, when I rewatched it, I was like, yeah, this guy's pretty good. He's the most memorable.
And partly because of that scene that you mentioned, the way he reacts, he's like, that's not, you didn't say that. Like the way their little like prickly interplay,
right.
But yet they're trying to be friends, but yet they're...
Some frenemy stuff hanging.
Yeah, it's a really neat dynamic in that scene.
One last thing I wanted to say about Austerlitz, and this is more a comment on just battles from this era, but do they really have like drummers and flautists just hanging out playing songs during, like, because then at what point as a drummer are you required to put down your drum and pick up a gun? Like, how bad do things have to get before you're like, all right, I'm done drumming. Like, I should probably help.
I think just what I picked up from historical fantasy novels and maybe history, like I think that both the drummers and the banner holders, even though they don't fight and they just go out on the field and get killed, they have like legitimate function on a battlefield. The drummer is to keep the troops marching marching together, because in order to be maneuvered tactically, they had to be really disciplined and stay in formation and all march at the same speed and stuff. And so I think they were like functional for that reason. But I'm talking out of my historical ass.
You know what you say to anyone who tries to call you out on it? What do you say, Ian?
You say,
were you there? Then shut the fuck up.
All right. So let's get on to one of the big turning points of the movie, which is the divorce. A sad scene, but also hilarious because Joaquin Phoenix is a blubbering idiot. He can't stop crying. Not that it's funny that he has to divorce his true love, just the fact that this is the king of France and he's in public acting like this.
That was good. And it's, both funny and compelling. I thought it was some of the best drama in the movie. And again, Vanessa Kirby's really good in this section. She does all these moments where she's sad, but she's breaking out laughing because of how ridiculous this is and the way he's acting. And so she plays these turns of emotion back and forth really fast that just make her really interesting to watch. And in the funny but sad category, he makes them both read these public statements as they sign their divorce papers publicly. And he makes her say, "Napoleon will always be my best friend." That's her divorce statement.
I think he actually makes her a pinky swear too. I don't know if you caught that. They got friendship bracelets.
There's a really tense, dramatic slap in the middle of that scene too. So it's funny and tense and sad and everything at once. Pretty good drama.
The fact that they're divorced is really upsetting because it means we won't get any more montages of Napoleon being a horny fucking weirdo. Because he is a horny weirdo. Boy, oh boy. There's three or four scenes where he just walks in a room where Josephine is with like her servants and just starts demanding sex in these more outlandish ways. He starts chuffing like a bull and like moving his feet, kicking his feet.
Paw on the ground a little bit.
And he goes, mm-mm-mm-mm-mm-mm-mm.
Yeah.
He crawls on the floor underneath the longest table I've ever seen to like drag her under it at the middle of a meal.
At least there's a little bit of tablecloth to keep it somewhat discreet for the servants.
I guess. A scene I really love, you called this out as like a real buzzkill moment where they're having dinner and he goes, "If you don't bear me a child tonight, there will be a divorce." And she's feeling surly, I guess. She goes, "There hasn't been enough lovemaking in this house to bear a child." And he's just like, "Yeah, there is."
He's very like, very matter of fact. "Yeah, there is. There's plenty."
And then she calls him fat and he goes, "I enjoy my meals." Like he just shrugs it off. He's like, "I do." Like it was just a very like realistic married couple fight when no one's really into it. No one's emotions are running super hot, but they're just like, they're fed up with each other kind of being shitheads.
It was good, real relationship stuff in the middle of, like you said, you don't expect it necessarily at the emperor's table in a period piece. Like you expect them to stay snooty, but this was down and dirty and real.
Speaking of down and dirty, Napoleon's dick game was trash. Now I've already made my feelings on that clear. Let's talk about Moscow a little bit. Really cool visual when he gets to Moscow and it's empty, just to see these huge streets and halls completely abandoned.
Yeah.
I did find that the march to Moscow was a little confusing narratively, like who's attacking who and why, where are they? Because you get some guerrilla warfare tactics from the
the Cossacks.
They weren't exactly Russians. Were. Yeah, the Cossacks. And it's not always filmed. And guerrilla warfare is another type of warfare that's hard to make cinematic. That the whole sequence when they're marching to Moscow was a little confusing and you're not really quite sure how bad things are for them. Are they winning? Are they losing? You see some bodies nailed to trees, but that's nothing new.
It is a slow grind. And I guess, as we know, they don't have that much time to devote to battles in this movie. So Napoleon's march on Moscow could be its own whole movie. So they fit it into a short little montage here. If you know that his march to Moscow was a like epic failure, it's very funny at the start when he's writing to Josephine and he says, "I see nothing but success in my future."
It's like a Curb Your Enthusiasm moment. Like they start playing the theme.
And then later, at the point you realize it's really getting bad because you see soldiers freezing to death, carving little scrapes off their own horses to eat. And then he's shouting to his soldiers, "We're winning." So it gets silly again in the midst of some harsh stuff.
I fucked Hitler up too, trying to march on Russia in the winter.
Yeah. No, it's like a...
It's a bad idea, man. Don't do it.
Classic blunder.
Yeah, he loses half a million troops, which is just... But I did think it was a little... We've seen him be victorious in battle so many times. And then he basically gets exiled without ever losing a battle. He lost a war without ever losing a battle.
Yeah.
Just because the elements really defeated him. And that might have been a little anticlimactic, but it also speaks to his hubris probably at that point where he thought he was undefeatable.
Yeah, and you're learning something about aristocracy and the way that Europe was ruled. His allies, all these other kings, threw their troops in under his command to do this thing. He fucked it up royally. pun intended. And then they gave him like the cushiest golden parachute exit ever, which we see parallels in modern corporate culture. It's like,
sure do.
CEOs can do the worst stuff and they still get the easiest landing. They're like, oh yeah, you get 2 million francs a year in your retirement to Elba and your ex-wife, he's divorced at this point, right? They set aside another million a year for Josephine just to be nice
and
she
gets to keep her servants. Yeah, like they really went all out for him.
And Elba, you know, we'll get to in the third act, he gets exiled again. Elba's pretty nice. I didn't really know my Mediterranean geography, but Elba is right there in between Italy and France. It's not far from where he grew up in Corsica. Like he's basically, they put him on an island so that he wouldn't cause trouble in Europe, but they put him in a part of the world where like he could still
drink good wine, eat good food.
Exactly. You know. Get the comforts of home.
Yeah. Exile fucking rules. Let's just be clear about this. If anybody ever wants me to go live on Elba and they'll pay me a few million dollars, have at it. Do your worst. I don't feel like we didn't get enough time on Elba to see like why he becomes disillusioned with it. I know it's because part of it's because Josephine gets sick and he wants to go be with her.
Yeah, there's kind of nothing for him to do but write letters when he's on Elba. So I guess didn't have a lot to show.
I mean, you get into the Warhammer, start doing those little figurine paintings. That seems to take up a lot of time.
I mean, right? If he had the internet back then, he would have probably just lived out his life there and had a good time.
Yet another tragedy by the internet or the lack of it.
Yeah.
That's all I got on the middle section of the movie. Should we get to the ending?
All right, let's bring it home. After less than a year in exile on Elba, a lonely Napoleon decides he must return home to reclaim his two loves, Josephine and France. He succeeds at recapturing his throne, but he fails with Josephine. She contracts diphtheria and dies before the two of them can reunite. Hearing of Napoleon's return, the other great powers of Europe, led by the Duke of Wellington, join forces to go to battle against him. And at the Battle of Waterloo, Napoleon tries to strike quickly before his allies can link up and achieve their full strength. But incessant rain and his own weariness seem to dull Napoleon's advantage, and his enemies are able to unite and defeat him. Shortly thereafter, Napoleon surrenders to the British and is exiled to the tiny, remote island of St. Helena in the South Atlantic. There he stays until a mere 6 years later, when he rejoins his beloved Josephine in death at the age of 51.
There it is. There's not a ton that happens in this section.
No, I was going to say things accelerate, which is good. It's good screenwriting, but it happens to be his life too. Like things accelerate in the third act. He comes back right away, has a showdown with everybody in Europe. His love dies and he's sent right back into exile.
The whole thing from his first exile to Elba towards his second exile to St. Helena is like 30 minutes, you know, like it's kind of crazy. It's kind of glossed over how he retakes his throne back.
They do it with a symbolic scene where he faces down one little regiment. Soldiers who are lined up to try to block him from marching back onto Paris. He's like, you guys, it's me. And they're like, yay, it's you. And that was kind of like that's all they got.
Yeah. And then they're like, he has 200,000 soldiers. It's like, no, that was like 80 people. What are you talking about? We could have got a montage of him just like coming up to all these battalions in the forest. He's like, come on.
Yeah. Yeah. He could have done that like 1,000 times. It's like a whole putting the band back together scene. Hey guys, it's right. Me, Napoleon. Come here, you rascal. Where you been?
They're like, how do we know you're Napoleon? And he puts his hand in shirt like in the painting and they're like, ah, it is you. Because like, how do you know what people looked like back then? It wasn't as easy as it is now.
No. I wonder, how many of those 100,000 guys that actually seen him in person could pick him out.
That stupid fucking hat, it's gotta be him.
Nobody would wear that.
Who would wear that? So then Josephine dies. A little anticlimactic because she dies off screen. They never get reunited, but again, we're beholden to history here.
And I thought that worked well for the drama of the movie. There's a cool scene where Napoleon finds out from her daughter that she's dead, and being the self-centered narcissist that he is, he's just really mad about not having been told. And we get it because like, hey, the movie didn't tell us either. We knew she was sick, but she died off screen and he's really weird in that scene too.
How bad is diphtheria?
Only thing I know about is it's the D in the DPT vaccine that you get when you're a kid.
Because it also killed Josephine Bonaparte.
I learned a second thing. I'll put that in my diphtheria book.
Because it just seemed like a sore throat and like a fever, which it's fucked up that you could just die of that back in the day.
I feel like, there could have been any number of those things.
I'm trying to see if Wikipedia has like a notable people who died from diphtheria, but no dice.
I thought you were about to read me a long list.
No, sorry.
Maybe it caught a lot of people at a young age before they could become notable.
Oh, interesting. Then there's Waterloo, which I'd certainly heard of, but didn't know a ton about ahead of this movie. What about you?
I knew that it's code for where you push things a little too far and you finally get your comeuppance. So for that reason, I knew what was going to happen at Waterloo. But it's the final battle of the movie. They try to make it the most epic. And in some ways it is. It's most sweeping as far as a big landscape where you can see the most number of troops at once in one shot.
I don't think it worked that well as a battle. battle, though, compared to some of the other ones we'd had. It was a little confusing. It wasn't always clear who had the advantage at what point, which maybe that was the idea, but it's just like, you've come to expect that. Battles go in waves and somebody will have the upper hand, somebody else will. I did like the British commander who's just like, we mustn't lose, or what will they say about us back in England?
Yeah, that's why I don't get the criticism that the French thought it made the British look good and the French bad. I think the British guy looked like an ass in this.
The British all look like idiots. Like when he curses that one guy out about the boats.
Yeah.
He's like, such ghastly manners. Like they're so British.
Yeah.
Just obsessed with manners.
I think the French were off on that. I think Scott did them right and they misinterpreted.
Yeah, I think the French are just prone to perceive slights.
I think you're right. The one signature move of Waterloo, it didn't have a decisive battle winner like the Icy Pond at Austerlitz. But there was an interesting move. The British infantry did the old Heaven's Gate maneuver. Anybody who's listened to the show long enough.
They went roller skating?
Yeah, they did a whole, they stopped and the fiddler started up and they did a whole roller dance scene. No, they formed a circle and did the Heaven's Gate move, which we know can tie up 20 minutes of screen time in a movie very, very easily.
At a minimum.
So they circled up and the French cavalry did their part by riding around them in circles ineffectually and just getting themselves slowly shot up by the infantry. And like with Heaven's Gate, it's like, why are they doing that? Does it make sense for either of them to fight that way? And then after doing that for 20 minutes, they both stopped. The French cavalry ran away and the British soldiers formed back into regular lines and they're just like, that happened.
The British kind of did like a phalanx thing. It was almost like Spartan. The way they banded together with their spears out.
It makes sense as a defense in both cases, in Heaven's Gate and this. In Heaven's Gate, they had some wagons tipped over so they could hide behind and shoot out of.
Yeah.
It never made sense to me in either movie why the people on horseback
would do that.
Just circle around until they got shot. Like you either you come in and you try to break through or you keep your distance, but the constant circling seems like doesn't help your case.
It's an odd choice, but battles were fucking stupid and weird back in the day.
Yeah.
They had drummers, for Christ's sakes. Let's not forget whatever reason they had for them. Such disdain in my voice. I'm sorry. Your explanation was good, and I appreciate the information. I just still think it's dumb.
I might have made it up, too.
So he loses. He's hanging out on a ship for some reason. British ship. And he's having a delicious breakfast. I wonder if it was the full English.
He's enjoying it.
Regaling some boys with tales of his conquests and giving them advice. And apparently even they are fans of Napoleon.
If you were a young British midshipman, and you could get some little war stories from the most famous general and emperor in Europe, you'd want to. But Wellington shoots them out and bursts Napoleon's bubble. He thinks he's still going to get the emperor treatment like he got last time. And he's like, I can't keep you here, buddy. You're lucky I kept you alive.
So they send him to St. Helena. Did you do any research about this island to see where it is?
I did. It's nowhere near anything. It's so far out there. Did you look it up?
No, but I know they mentioned it's just a few hundred miles off the coast of Africa, right?
I thought it was like 1,000 miles off the coast. It's a really tiny island and it's really far. Obviously, incredibly far from Europe, not as far from Africa, but like they measure it in terms of like also how far it is from Brazil. So like it's got to be pretty far out there in the Atlantic if you're thinking about which way should I go to get to land.
Yeah, he had it made in Elba. What an idiot, this dumbass. Now he's stuck on St. Helena.
I looked up the history. This time they didn't just let him chill. That he was there with 27 hangers-on, his entourage that he brought with him. And there was a garrison of like 2,500 troops there to make sure that he didn't leave the island this time.
But it seems like he's left to his own devices as long as he stays put. He's not like in chains or anything. He's sitting in a garden comfortably, regaling some young girls with made-up tales of his military. That's another time when we see him, we catch him in a lie.
Oh,
where he asked them what the capital of Russia was, and they said Moscow or St. Petersburg. It used to be Moscow. And he goes, do you know who burned Moscow to the ground? They go, who? He says, I did. They goes, no, wasn't it the Russians?
Didn't they do it to themselves?
Yes. And then he dies immediately of embarrassment.
The movie ends on a gag. It ends on the sad thing.
He just tips over.
Because there's this voiceover of Josephine, which we're accustomed to her writing him actual letters. And now it's the letters in his mind from beyond the grave. And yeah, it's just a shot behind him and he just flops over, keels over sideways.
Do we know what he died of?
I looked it up. It said the scholars think it was stomach cancer. He died at 51. And like that happened fast too. Everything accelerates at the end of the story and the end of his life.
What'd you think of the voiceover from Josephine beckoning him to join her in the afterlife? I thought it was like a little creepy. There's a menacing quality to her voice there, but also a little sweet.
Yeah. And if you feel sympathetic towards him at the end of the movie, you go, okay, at least he believed he was joining his love as he passed away. Happy ending, I guess.
So that's Napoleon. A funnier movie than I expected. A strange ass, super expensive biopic that could only be made by a man like Ridley Scott, who's so sure of himself to just make this strange movie.
If you've got the time and you like Joaquin Phoenix, if you have some interest in Ridley Scott's movies, it's pretty fun. Despite being so long, it doesn't really get boring. I was entertained.
No, it's not boring at all. I have no issue with the runtime, really. And if they do come out with that 4-hour cut, I said we're still waiting on it. Like, this movie didn't come out only less than 2 months ago.
Give them a minute.
But if they do come out with that 4-hour cut, I'll watch it.
Yeah.
You know, I sat through the fucking Snyder Cut. Why wouldn't I check this out?
Yeah.
Do you want me to talk a little bit about Ridley Scott and what he's working on?
I can't believe he's still working, but sounds like he is.
Is he ever? So we know he's got Gladiator 2 coming out relatively soon. That can't be good, right? There's no way that's going
to
be good.
But I'm going to try to withhold judgment. I'm not sure how much I liked Gladiator. I think I never got fully on board. Like, Gladiator had a strong fandom, and I think I like thought it was okay and never like really got big into it. So I don't have a lot of writing on whether Gladiator 2 is good.
See, I was a big fan of Gladiator 1, but I think a lot of how you feel about it depends on how old you were when you first saw it. And I was like 14 when Gladiator came out, which I feel is the perfect time. I was like, fuck yeah, Russell Crowe's got swords, he's killing people. And then when you watch it and you're a little older, you're like, there's not much there. Joaquin Phoenix is a maniac in it. It was when I first noticed him acting with a capital A, as I like to say. He certainly is going for it in that movie, but it got him a lot of attention and a lot of roles down the road. So
I remember that. Yeah, I remember him being a phenomenon coming out of that.
Yeah, and I'm sure I'll check out Gladiator 2 and I'll probably check out Gladiator 1 ahead of time, but it doesn't seem like a movie that's suited for a sequel to me, especially 20 years after the first one, 25 years after the first one by the time we get it.
That's what they said about Top Gun Maverick, and we got surprised.
Slightly different. Maverick was still in Top Gun Maverick.
That's true.
There was something more tying it to the original. So he's got that coming out in 2024. It's in post-production now. He has Wraiths of the Broken Land in pre-production, which is a Western written by Drew Goddard and Craig Zahler, which some names I recognize as being good. A father attempts to rescue his daughters from a brothel with the help of his two sons and their outlaw gang. No cast yet as far as I can see, but yeah, that sounds cool. I'll check that out. We need more Westerns.
Yeah.
He's got a TV miniseries in development called Roads to Freedom. 10-episode epic that will tell the story of World War II from several international perspectives. That's not a small project either. This guy's got to be. No. These are huge undertakings that this guy is going out for. And then he's got Queen and Country, which he is in development. A special ops agent is on the run after assassinating a powerful figure in Eastern Europe. These are wildly diverse genres he's working in, and also a lot of period pieces, which I feel like are just a huge pain in the ass to direct. Huge undertakings.
He has no fear, no hesitation. He's a machine. I hope someone is studying him in real time, because the work that he's putting out is pretty incredible.
And I hate to even bring this up, but anytime someone's in their mid-80s, you're like, what's their mental situation like? But if you see interviews with him, he looks spry. He's on the ball. He's like very there. He's very present. If only American politicians could learn something from him.
Yeah. It's interesting. Genetics allows certain people to be really different at certain ages. We all hope that we keep running pretty well towards the end, but it's interesting when a very visible figure like this has a certain energy at an age.
It makes me sad even more sad for Tony Scott, because like he could have still been cranking out good stuff into his golden years. He was a director I think I actually preferred to Ridley Scott, even though I'm a fan of both. R.I.P. Tony Scott. Very sad.
Yeah, he's missed.
But when Joaquin doesn't have much on his docket, he's been so busy that I think he's slowing down a little bit now, but he does have Joker Folie à Deux coming out.
Oh, well, that's pretty big.
Yeah, that'll be a big one. But so he's also got a Todd Haynes movie in development, which Todd Haynes, we just talked about him, the director of Dark Waters in May, December. I think that would be pretty good.
Yeah.
Polaris is set in Alaska during the 1890s when an ice photographer meets the devil.
Whoa.
That's a banana sounding synopsis.
I love it.
Yeah, I'm totally on board. Directed by Lynn Ramsey, who did We Need to Talk About Kevin and You Were Never Really Here, two movies that I really enjoyed. It's weird to say you enjoyed We Need to Talk About Kevin, but it was well made. And I admired that. It almost sounds like the new season of True Detective, which takes place in the modern day, but is similarly set in the Arctic and seems to have some supernatural goings on.
I'm going to have to turn that on. I haven't checked it out yet.
It's good.
Okay.
Really good. And then The Island, he is also starring in. He's got two movies that he's starring with Rooney Mara in.
Oh.
Are they a couple?
Maybe.
Because she's his co-star in Polaris and The Island.
Oh.
A couple decides to turn their backs on civilization to build their private paradise on a desert island. However, a millionaire passing through the island makes them a sensation, causing a European countess to want to take over the island. Interesting.
That sounds cool. People magazine says Joaquin Phoenix and Rooney Mara met on the set of the 2013 film Her and welcomed their first child together in 2020.
Oh, nice. So they're doing the old husband and wife collaborator. Are they married?
Like
partners. They're not married. They never actually married, but they're doing the old couple making movies together thing. That's never backfired for anyone. Let's talk about Vanessa Kirby a bit. So she really seems to be following the old school one for them, one for me rule. Make a commercial, big budget movie, and then make a small, weird movie. She's a fixture in the Mission Impossible franchise now. She's even in the Fast and the Furious universe because she played Jason Statham's character's sister in the Hobbs and Shaw spinoff.
Oh, I didn't realize.
She hasn't popped in any of the mainline ones ones yet, but there's still time. Because I think the whole gang's coming back for the final two.
Oh, okay. Good luck to them.
Yeah, sure. I haven't seen the last couple. I'm kind of out on them. But she's also done smaller movies like Pieces of a Woman, The World to Come, The Sun. She's got the upcoming Mission Impossible movie. And then listen to this cast. It's a survival thriller called Eden, directed by Ron Howard. It will star Vanessa Kirby, Jude Law, Ana de Armas, Daniel Brühl, and Sydney Sweeney.
Oh.
That is a sexy cast.
And Ron Howard, not a super sexy director, but
interesting. Or not a super sexy man either, let's be honest.
No, but very charming.
No, he doesn't do it for me. Very charming, very nice. Yeah, I wonder how he's going to handle that. Just they're all wearing like the baggiest clothes for the entire film. You're like, fuck Ron Howard. How'd you fuck this up so bad?
You ruined it.
You ruined it. That's all I got. Because like we said, this movie is truly a two-hander. There's no other actors I wanted to shout out.
Yeah, there's kind of nobody else to talk about.
Did you have any closing thoughts or should I reveal our final movie of our 2023 Bombathon?
Ooh, let's jump on that. What's coming up next?
We're doing our first foray into the MCU.
Wow.
It's fucked up because that could be any number of movies now. There's a few that qualify.
Oh, yeah.
We've done Marvel before when we did The Punisher, but that wasn't MCU. That was before they did that. Yeah. We're going to do the Marvels.
Okay.
There's a lot of toxicity around the Captain Marvel character and the Marvels movie from a certain section of the internet. And we're not going to look at it through that lens, rest assured. We have no problem with female superheroes.
No, we sometimes have to acknowledge the weird corners of discourse around movies. I don't think that's why Marvel as a whole is having trouble making money like they used to at the box office, but that's kind of what we have to think about as we watch the Marvels right. And figure out why didn't it make more?
Why isn't this working anymore? That worked so well for so long. So that'll be fun. And then we'll get back to a random selection of movies from various years, which we've got some fun ones planned for that too. So stay tuned.
Just a grab bag for the rest of the year.
It's not a grab bag for the rest of the year because we got to bring back Blastober. We missed a year.
I know. We missed a Blastober. Well, it's fun when we organize a couple months around themes. So now we've got this new tradition we're trying in January. Maybe we'll think of some other month where we bundle a few movies together.
There are plenty of actors we could do like a whole month on. There are plenty of directors we could do a whole month on.
That's true.
Yeah, there's lots of options. And you know what, guys? Give us some suggestions.
Yeah.
You can hit us up on Twitter at BlastZonePod. Email BlastZonePod@gmail.com if there's any theme months you think would be cool.
Love to hear the ideas.
So thank you guys so much for listening. Please remember to rate, review, and subscribe to the pod if you can. Spotify lets you give ratings. Those, I think, help get us in front of more people, especially because the algorithm seems to have buried us a little bit after our sabbatical.
We're trying to dig ourselves back out.
Apple Podcasts, of course, you can rate and leave a review. Those are helpful too. But we appreciate you. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next time in the Blast Zone.
See you next time in the Blast Zone. The Blast Zone.